Hi everyone, my name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
For the new people this evening, I forgot what I was going to say.
Thanks for sharing. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Bill?
No, for the new people this evening, this meeting does get taped. And Bill and I go an hour, we go through the book, and then at 8:30, we open it up for a half hour for discussion, for question and answers, or whatever you want to do. During that time, we shut the tape off, just for anyone who's concerned about that. Do you want to say something?
And very often the tapes are used for people that weren't here in past sessions and stuff, so they can catch up or whatever. So if at any point during the beginning part somebody wants to say something they don't want to have it on tape, we can pause it. So just to throw that out.
Okay. Just as a brief review, which are getting longer and longer each week, this is the fifth week that we're doing this. The first week we covered the circle and triangle, the table of contents, and I believe we took a look at the preface and the forwards. With the circle and triangle, we looked at the fact that that's an ancient spiritual symbol representing mind, body, and spirit, and for us it represents recovery, unity, and service. The foundation of the triangle, or the base of the triangle, is recovery, and that's the 12 steps. The left side of the triangle is unity, and we find unity in the fellowship, and also connected to unity are the 12 traditions. And the right side of the triangle is service, and connected to service are the 12 concepts. So instead of 12 spiritual principles, like I had thought for a long time, what AA really has to offer in the way of steps, traditions, and concepts are 36 spiritual principles, which, if practiced as a way of life, can enable anyone who wishes to recover to become happily and usefully whole. The triangle is within a circle, and the circle represents that we can become whole in the three areas of body, mind, and spirit. So then we took a look at the table of contents. We saw how the book is laid out in a precise, clear-cut, and specific way. It starts out with a description of the problem. It goes on to give us a solution for the problem. And then it goes on to give us a practical program of action, which, if carried out, will bring about the solution to a problem. We looked at some history and some statistics in the forwards. That brought us to the second week. We looked at the doctor's opinion. Dr. Silkworth gave us the first part of the first step, which is how we're powerless over alcohol in the body. And he describes to us how when alcoholics put any alcohol into the system whatsoever, it sparks off a craving for more alcohol. And he refers to this as the phenomena of craving. We found out that the phenomena of craving only occurs in alcoholics. It doesn't happen in the average, normal, temperate drinker. Then the next week, we went on to Bill's story, and we broke Bill's story up into two parts. We saw that the first eight pages deal basically with Bill's drunkalog and his problem, and the last eight pages of Bill's story deals with what he did to recover, which is the solution. We threw out an exercise that if you take the first eight pages and you go through it and mark those parts with in which you can identify with Bill in the way he thought, felt, and drank. And we're able to see that it doesn't matter that Bill got sober in the 1930s, we didn't. We're in the 2000s. Doesn't matter that Bill was a man and maybe we're not. Doesn't matter that Bill was born in Vermont and he lived a large portion of his life in New York. It doesn't matter that Bill was a stockbroker. What matters is that the way that Bill thought, felt, and the way he drank, and if we can identify in those three areas that maybe we have this illness also. Then we took a look at the last eight pages of Bill's story, and that's what Bill did to recover. And we use pages 9 through 16 as a tool to go through for me to mark anything that Bill did that I'm not willing at this present moment to do to recover. And that's kind of a good gauge for us, a good guide to not only let us know, but also to let our sponsors know that, hey, maybe these are some of the areas where we're going to need a little more attention, a little more help. And after that, we covered some material in There's a Solution. I believe that particular week we looked at pages 17 through 20. Not that I remember. But we looked at that the first half of There is a Solution mainly deals with the problem. And then the second half of There is a Solution deals with the solution, obviously. But we also looked at some points in that chapter for the mental obsession. We said earlier in this thing that we're going to use from the doctor's opinion to page 23 to look at the part of the first step which deals with the body, the physical craving, the alcohol. And we said we're going to look at pages 23 to 43 which deal with the mental obsession. And then we're going to look at page 52 and other parts of the book which deal with the spiritual malady, which we call the third part of the first step. But if you look at the first step on the wall or off out of the book on page 59, it deals with that our lives have become unmanageable. So we look at that. We look at the spiritual malady for anything that's after the dash in the first step. So we used parts of There's a Solution for the mental obsession. Last week we covered pages 20 to 29. We looked at the three different types of drinkers, and we really focused on what a real alcoholic is, and we also focused on what a real alcoholic isn't. And that brings us up to this week. Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, page 30. You got anything you want to add before we get going? Cool.
I almost got them.
You gotta have those. Those are great.
Right, I almost got them. I got the black ones.
I got those too.
Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism. And one thing I didn't mention as we go along in these weeks, and which is seemingly going to look like months, we take as many statements as we can in the book and turn them into questions so that we can ask ourselves, thanks Bob, so that we can ask ourselves if, and you weren't even here the first 4 weeks. We take statements, turn them into questions so that we can ask ourselves if that applies to us. So before we get into chapter, let's open up with the set-aside prayer, and Bill's going to take us through that.
Before we begin, I just wanted to apologize to the group because I've been kind of weepy for the past 3 days, so if I just start crying, hopefully it's not making anybody uncomfortable. This is the set-aside prayer, if we could say it together. Dear God,
please set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, the big book, the 12 steps, the program, the fellowship, the people in the fellowship, in all spiritual terms, especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things Please help me see the truth.
Amen.
Page 30, chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics, and we find a really good description of a real alcoholic in chapter 2, and Bill's story also gives us a really good example of a real alcoholic. No person likes to think that he is bodily because of the physical craving or the physical allergy alcoholics have to alcohol, and mentally, which is the mental obsession, different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. So take that statement and turn it around into a question to ask yourself. Has your drinking career been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that you can drink like other people? And for me, that's a definite yes. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And what I like to do is also personalize this for myself and put my name in there or replace pronouns with the word I. So the idea that somehow, someday, Mike will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession or lie of every abnormal drinker. Just in the next couple pages, Bill W. is going to use about, at least to my count, four different words to mean the same thing. He's going to use four different words to describe the word lie. And Bill or myself will point those out as we go along. The persistence of this illusion, again, lie, is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learn that we had to fully concede or admit to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. So when I'm bringing someone through to work, when we get to this point, I ask them this question. Have you learned so far that you have to fully concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic? And definitely in my case, that would be a yes.
1, 2, 3.
Bill did a study a couple weeks ago over a period of weeks and weeks and months and months.
Last year.
And was it last year?
Yeah.
I think it started in 2000.
No, 2 years ago. Thanks. Yeah, because last year I was in Philly.
Thanks for correcting me.
You said a couple weeks ago.
Did I?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean a couple weeks ago. A couple years ago. You want to take over? And the way we did this whole turn the statement into a question to answer for yourself was that Bill kind of read the statement and then did 1, 2, 3, and then everyone was supposed to answer yes or no. And I have no idea why I brought that up. I guess you had to be there. We're not going to do that here, though. So we learned, Mike
I never
learned,
did it before or since, so you're not very bad.
Mike learned that he had to fully concede to his innermost self that Mike is a real alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion, or again the word lie, that we are like other people or presently may be, and that's interesting, has to be smashed. So when I first got here over 8 years ago, I had to see that I had to get past the delusion that I am like other people or that I can drink like other people. But what about now? What about my current experience with the first step? What about 8 years into this thing? What about all this experience that I supposedly have with working the steps and in AA and helping other people? It says, or presently maybe. All this stuff that I've done over the years, is that enough to make me like other people? Is that enough to make me like my neighbor who can have one or two drinks and just go on with the rest of the day? You know? So Bill's hooking us right back to the present, right back to the here and now. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. Notice that the word ever is in italics. So am I a person that has lost the ability to control my drinking? And do I suffer from the illusion that I will ever regain control? All of us felt at times that we are regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. And I can look upon my own drinking experience and see if what this book is telling me is true. Over any considerable period of my drinking, is it true that I got worse and not better? We are like men who have lost their legs, they never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. And that's because of our allergic reaction to alcohol once we put it in our body. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. And it's even in 2002, it still hasn't done so yet. You want to pick it up? Okay. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in this class. By every form of self-deception, and that's the fourth reference to the word lie, and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Next paragraph gives some methods that we have tried. I'm just going to quickly go through it.
So again, ask yourself if you've tried these.
Right. So here are some methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, and I love this, not taking a trip, swearing off forever with or without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books. Does anyone have a self-help library in their home?
Oh, absolutely.
Notice
it says we don't do anything. We just read them. We read them, but we don't do what it says.
They look good. Yeah.
So he wants me to do something, I'll pick up another book.
Going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list and ad infinitum. Next paragraph is going to give us a test. There's actually two tests in this particular chapter. The first test is going to deal with the physical craving to see if we have the physical allergy to alcohol. If someone comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm talking to them and they tell me that, I'm not really sure if I'm an alcoholic or not, I don't just automatically point them to page 31 and tell them to do this test. What the people did with me were they were kind enough to take me through the doctor's opinion and from page 1 to page 31, and if I'm still not convinced that I'm a real alcoholic, then suggest this test to me. So here's the test. We do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take long for you to decide if you're honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition. Something else that we suggest, which hooks into this test, is that try drinking 2 drinks a day, no more, no less, for 30 days. And again, this isn't saying that you necessarily have to do this. This is just suggesting that you conjure this test in your mind and see how you react to it. So, if I were to throw out the suggestion to anyone in this room, if you're not convinced at this point that you're a real alcoholic, try drinking 2 drinks a day for 30 days, no more, no less. You have to drink the two drinks each day, and you can't save them up. Think about how you would react to that. You know, my mind says to me, "Ooh, you know, first of all, I couldn't go through with the test. I know through my own experience that I would overshoot the mark at some point. If it wasn't the first night, that's just torturous drinking, you know." And I think that's the type of response that they were looking for. Because I worked with someone recently where the idea of taking 2 drinks a day for 30 days, I brought that up to this person, and they're like, "That's too much. I can never do that." So we kind of came to the we came to the conclusion that this person is not a real alcoholic. You know, if you're thinking that that's just way entirely too much alcohol for you, you're probably in the wrong room. For anyone who's interested, I guess Bill can send you out an email. You want to? We used to refer to this 2 drinks a day for 30 days. We used to refer to this as the Marty Mann test, but Bill did some research, and
I didn't do any research.
Somebody else did some research. And
I landed on it.
And we also found out that the Marty Mann test is actually a little different.
It's significantly different than that, but that is a good test. And like Mike said, it's important to point out that, you know, it doesn't say if you're not sure you're an alcoholic, go drink. It says try some controlled drinking. But we've given you almost 40 pages worth of information. With that information, now try some controlled drinking to see if you get that allergy or that craving for more alcohol once you start. So, but the Marty Mann test, from what I remember, it says try this for at least 6 months, and it says depending upon how you drank, use this test. That if you only drank on weekends, then you only use this test on weekends. If you drank every day, then use this test every day. And it said to drink no less than 2 and no more than 3. Why she worded it that way, I have no idea. But and for those of you that didn't know, Marty Mann is a female. But it was kind of interesting because it was, you know, I had heard about it for years. And then to actually read it, it was a little bit different than what we were being told. But it's still a form of controlled drinking. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting idea after being given a whole lot of information. Because I've been at meetings where the people, you know, if you're not sure you're an alcoholic, well, go drink. Well, that's not what this book is saying. It's very specifically saying, here's a whole bunch of information. If you're still not sure you're an alcoholic, try some controlled drinking. And like Mike said, for most people, just the thought of it can drive them in either direction. The thought will be, I don't even want to consider that because I've never been able to have 2 drinks. And, you know, the other group of people that will be driven the other way will be like, well, why would I want to drink all that? 2 drinks every day for 30 days, why would I want to drink all that? So, you know, without actually doing it, sometimes the test is effective. But, you know, in certain cases, trying that test will at least reveal whether you have the allergy and the craving or not, because that only happens if you're an alcoholic. Also, it's sort of a joke. Back on the first page of this chapter, it talks about, in the middle of the first paragraph, it says the idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession or lie of every abnormal drinker. What's interesting about that statement is that to control and enjoy, we're not able to do both. There are times that we can control our drinking, but we're not enjoying it. And there are times that we can enjoy our drinking, but it doesn't look like we're controlling it. So it's sort of a joke that if you're an alcoholic, you can do one of those, but you can't do both. But, you know, our mind still tells us we can. So, you know, that's sort of an interesting little test in and of itself as well, that, you know, am I past the point of controlling and enjoying it? Because I know my first wife became a drink counter, and there were times that, you know, I was at a business thing, so I had to hold back, you know, and it was not enjoyable. It was not enjoyable, and when I was able to do whatever I wanted to do, I was out of control. So, you know, more statements. They ask yourself, you know, it's describing an alcoholic. You ask if that's your experience.
Did you say your first wife was a drink counter?
Yeah, she became a drink counter.
I get, like, a picture of one of those little clickers.
No, she was very bright, so she didn't need the clicker. She had a mental clicker. But, you know, it was the kind of, you know, like, I wanted to hang out, and she wanted to go home.
Sick.
So I would say, okay, well, you know, you brought your car, so, you know, I want to say goodbye to a few people, and I'll be right behind you.
2 hours.
I did that a few times. I did that a few times, and or, you know, that, you know, the next day, or a
couple days behind you. For anyone who's wondering, Marty Mann was the first woman in Alcoholics Anonymous to maintain permanent sobriety. She started the National Council on Alcoholism. And I believe where that the test that Bill was describing, where that comes from is a book that she wrote, Marty Mann's New Primer on Alcoholism. So if you have entirely too much time on your hands, like we seem to have, you might want to check that out. Back to the book. Though there is no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. We have heard of few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here is one.
A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. So they're identifying it as an alcoholic because he has the allergy. And it said earlier a couple times that only an alcoholic will have that craving for more alcohol. He made up his mind, so he takes out willpower, that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Notice it says that his business career was successful and happy, but since he was bone dry, I wonder if he was. Then he felt victim to the belief or the lie, which practically every alcoholic has. So again, ask yourself if you have this thought, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men, so he became cured. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in the hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking, so now he's trying moderation for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime, then gathering all his forces, and all his forces are self-will and self-knowledge. He attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man of retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead after 4 years. Now, something I like asking people that I work with at that point is, did alcohol kill this guy, or did the belief that he could drink like a normal man kill this guy? Because for me, like it'll say throughout this chapter, the drink starts well before we put it in our body. I think it's an important distinction that it's not the first drink that gets me drunk. It's my mind telling me it's okay to take the first drink that gets me drunk. Because once my mind doesn't see what it's about to do is wrong or harmful, there was nobody that could stop me from taking my first drink. So this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. And of course, drinking normally for an alcoholic is a gray area. But here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in short time as bad as ever. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind or any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. So for me, that's sort of the second statement that the book made. First, it said that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. Now it's saying that we must have no reservation, that in the future we can drink and not be affected. So there's sort of two tests there. Also, it's interesting. I had stopped drinking for a year and 3 weeks. And once I started again, it was like I had never stopped. That within a few weeks or within like a month, I was partying more than when I had stopped the year before. So for me, that's kind of interesting. It continued. My body continued not being able to deal with alcohol. And once I started, I was off to the races, past the point that I had stopped the year before that. Young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop as he did on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it, because none will really want to stop, and hardly one of them, because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find he can win out. So again, they're talking about the mental part there, that our mind just doesn't see the truth about what's going on. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, have been drinking only a few years, but have found themselves as helpless as those who have been drinking 20 years. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantities some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. Certain drinkers who would be greatly insulted if called alcoholics are astonished at their inability to stop. We who are familiar with the symptoms see large numbers of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere, but try to get them to see it. I know in some of my experiences with people, especially young, is that whole indestructible mentality. But again, you know, it's saying that it doesn't matter how much we drink or what we drink. I think that's an important distinction, that a person's bottom has absolutely nothing to do with their outsides. That a person's bottom has to do with that gut experience that they have with themselves. It doesn't matter if I'm living under a bridge. It doesn't matter if, I drank large quantities every day. None of that matters. What matters is, do I lose control once I start? And when I stop, when I really want to not turn to it again, do I end up turning to it again?
I also like to suggest if, at this point, if the mental obsession is leading you to take a drink every day, even if it's just two or three drinks every day, and if you still have the mental obsession and do that, that's still in line with the description of an alcoholic in this book. And if when you put alcohol into your system and it only sparks the craving for three or four drinks, and if at that point you pass out or whatever, still that's the physical craving. So you still have the symptoms of the mind and the body. You know, again, like Bill said, we don't have to drink large quantities of alcohol to be alcoholics. I know people who got sober at the age of 16. You know, they did not do a lot of drinking. When I first came into AA, there was this set of brothers, and I believe one brother was 14 and the other brother was 15. And they were real alcoholics. They had only drank for a couple years. But once they put any alcohol into their system, they had to drink until capacity. And time after time after time, their mind, even when they knew that they were getting into trouble, even at that early age, their mind would bring them back to the drink, and that's the mental obsession. So, alcoholism doesn't care how old you are. It doesn't care if you're white, black, or whatever, nationality, religion. It doesn't care.
As we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our willpower. If anyone questions, now here's another test. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. If he is a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there is scant or very little chance of success.
Leave it alone for 1 year. No AA, no sponsor, no spirituality, no God, no 12 steps. Leave liquor alone for 1 year, go about your life, and see how you do.
I did that for 18 months. And I had, fortunately, nothing of the tools that you said. The problem was that, and it wasn't even white knuckle, I would say, it really wasn't. I really wanted to be sober. But I had one disappointment. Just one thing really hit me, and I had no defense whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you can pass this,
right,
it doesn't mean that you're recovered in any way, in my case.
I believe it talks about later on in this chapter that we can't have any reservation or any lurking notion that somehow, someday, we can drink like normal people, you know. And like you said, John, you just had to have that one excuse or that one whatever, and boom, right back there. So that's definitely a good example. They should have John's story in here. That would be another good example.
It'd be long.
So the first test was the physical one. The second test is the mental one. And, you know, again, if I had been asked that when I was out there, that was a joke. I mean, you just don't understand. To ask me to not drink for a year, you just don't understand. I drink to deal with life. Going a year without it is not reasonable.
But I could quit if I really wanted to.
In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remained sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay dry anything like a year. Some will be drunk the day after making their resolutions, most of them within a few weeks. And I know for me, it was even sometimes later that day. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. And now it's going to make an assumption, and I don't like that word. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. And that's another aspect of working with people. Recently, I was told that I don't want help. I don't want to stop. And it's interesting because I've only heard that a couple times, and this time it was interesting how I internalized that. I mean, I felt almost as if I stared at the devil himself in the face. In hearing what this person had been going through and all that, to be given some information and then their choice be that I don't want any help. I mean, it was an interesting kind of thing for me, because this whole ego deflation and this whole, you know, ego, good dog, bad, you know, I don't want to get into that yet. The whole, you know, self-will, ego-driven life and the whole God-will, spiritual, altruistic life thing is real heavy in my focus. And, I mean, I was looking at that guy's ego straight in the face. And it was hard to hear him say that to me. Because you don't understand, I want to save you. You know what I mean?
Notice that the phraseology here is desires to stop. What's one of our traditions say? You know, that we have a desire to stop drinking, and in the beginning it said an honest desire to stop drinking. So, you know, if the reader of this book doesn't desire to stop, he should no more go on with what this book says than he would be qualified to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the third tradition says that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And if you don't have that desire, then sorry, come back when you do.
Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. And I guess that's kind of what John was talking about. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling, this is a great definition of powerlessness. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, the utter or the total inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. And you might have remembered last week, I think, we touched upon where it said that, you know, a non-alcoholic has a take-it-or-leave-it-alone kind of relationship, and now it's saying an alcoholic does not have that. We don't have a take-it-or-leave-it-alone. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction, since we have to diagnose ourselves, whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to the alcoholic sufferers and perhaps the medical fraternity. So now this next line is important. So we shall describe some of the mental states which precedes a relapse into drinking, for obviously that is the crux, which means the perplexing difficulty of the problem. So again, it's not the first drink that gets us drunk. It's our mind telling us it's okay to take that drink that gets us drunk. What sort of thinking dominates, and notice that word, dominates, an alcoholic repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink. Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into the saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? You know, again, they're having a completely different experience than we're having. We drink because we need it. We drink because at times it's still in our body and we're craving more of it. They don't get that. They see that it's causing us problems. We don't see that it's causing us problems.
Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. I love that. A lot of the drunks in this book have a nervous disposition. As did I. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. Good news for him, huh? Here's a little 12-step tip. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer that we had found. So if we're working with a new prospect, that's what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to tell him what we know of alcoholism through our own personal experience and the answer that we have. Jim made a beginning. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for a business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but Jim failed to enlarge his spiritual life. So he made a beginning. He probably did the first couple steps, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life by not doing the rest of the steps. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. A half a dozen times in rapid succession, and they still worked with him. They were still willing to work with Jim. You know, and I thank God that our early pioneers in AA were willing to go to any lengths to help somebody who wanted to be helped. You know, and that's also a good sponsorship tool for me today. That if I'm working with a sponsee who just goes back to drinking time and time and time again, does this book say that I'm supposed to drop him? If he really wants to recover and he's really trying? No, it tells me that I'm supposed to keep on working with him. Now, if he doesn't show interest, we're going to find over on page 96 that, yeah, we're supposed to move on to the next person. If he doesn't show interest and he really doesn't want to quit drinking for good and for all, then we're just wasting our time and he's wasting his time, so we're supposed to move on to the next person. But for someone who's really trying and really wants to recover, this book tells me that I'm supposed to hang in there with him.
And notice it says they're reading carefully, so it's not some haphazard, you know, just sit down and don't talk for a while. They sat down with him, they reviewed what had happened. How I'd like to describe that is perhaps, you know, see what he was doing, see where he was lacking, and fill in the gaps. For me, that would be reviewing carefully. You know, where are you lacking? The program says we need to be doing all of this. What part of it are you missing? For me, I always like pointing out that part about that he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. I'd like to suggest that every person in all of AA that ever relapsed, that was the reason why. If every single time I've ever talked to somebody who relapsed, I talk to them about where they were falling short, or, you know, were you doing, did you go through all of the steps, did you make all of your amends, did you, were you doing morning prayer and meditation, were you doing an evening review, were you working with other people, were you getting involved in service work, how many meetings were you going to? At some point, if not all of those questions would be no, or you know, there was some place that they fell short. But like Mike had said, I've never known anyone who was involved in all three parts of the triangle that went back to drinking, because they were growing spiritually, they were working with people, they were going to meetings, they were involved in a program. I don't think it's a coincidence.
Yeah, Bob.
Just something brief. Yesterday I was having a conversation with somebody, and they were thinking about coming back to the fellowship. And so, what step were you on before you left the last? They said, well, I sort of did a fourth step, and I sort of was working on my ninth step. And I'm like, well, do you think you'd be interested in doing the 12 steps? This is basically a 12-step program. And they says, well, I just don't want to drink. I says, but sometimes the drink isn't the issue. Sometimes the issues are the issues, and the steps help you through that to a spiritual drink. And it was so amazing because this person did not do the work. They just wanted the results. And you know, it's like what you were saying. It's amazing that there's so many people that have never really gone through the steps at all. I mean, let alone the work we do them here. You know, it's like, you know, a lot of times I'll sit back and think, where was I for the 13 years? You know? But then I was given the opportunity to do it. So I hadn't done it yet, but it was in the works. When I look back at the 13 years, it was preparing me to see that this is the solution.
A good example. I know a guy that he had 92 amends. He did all the steps preceding the ninth step, and he made 91 out of 92 of his amends. He refused to make that last amends, and he drank again. So what Bill was talking about, not only does that apply in an example like Bob just gave in the beginning, where, you know, the person did very little work at all. Here's a guy that took inventory, did a fifth step, asked for his character defects to be removed, became willing to make amends, made 91 out of 92 amends, and held on to that little bit of unwillingness to entirely clean up his past, and he drank again. So that's always a good example for me. So again, they reviewed carefully what had happened. Jim agreed that he was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had deep affection. Yet he got drunk again.
Hate that.
That's the seventh time now. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. Again, they carefully reviewed with him. So this is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. Wonder where he was all day on Monday, huh? I remember I felt irritated that I had been a salesman for a concern I once owed. And of course, him saying he felt a little irritated, I'm sure that's an understatement. I had a few words with the boss. Again, probably another understatement. But nothing serious.
And remember earlier it's saying that in these stories that follow, we're going to talk about the mental states that precede drinking. These stories are not here to talk about people, places, and things or anything like that. These are to talk about the mental state that precedes drinking. And that's Jim's mental state before he took a drink, which is later on in the story.
Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. And, back in the 1930s, it was not uncommon for a roadside place to have a bar. Most of them probably had it. So there's really nothing peculiar here about Jim's behavior, except for the fact that he's irritated and he's probably milking a resentment here. Quite frankly, he's probably pissed off that he has to go work for a guy that took over his business because he lost it because he was a drunk. But I don't judge. So on the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. You know, again, this is not stinking thinking going on here. And again, like Bill said, this is not people, places, and things. I just thought I would get a sandwich. You know, again, if a person is hungry, they're going to stop at a restaurant and have a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years. I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. And if a person is hungry and they're thirsty, they're going to order a sandwich and a glass of milk. Nothing peculiar about this type of behavior. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Still not really peculiar. I mean, if he's still hungry after the first sandwich and he's still thirsty after the first glass of milk, then maybe he's going to order another sandwich and another glass of milk. You know, he may want to consider the fact that he's got a little OA thing going on there, but, you know, nonetheless, this is an example about alcohol. By the way, I want to say this earlier. If anyone has other afflictions or other addictions that, you know, if you're currently in another 12-step program for them, or if you're currently battling with some things, when we're going through the first step this time, take those things through the first step too. You know, and maybe possibly as a group, we can have a new experience with those things too. So again, he ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. But here's the kicker. Suddenly, and notice that the next few lines are going to be in italicized writing. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it in the milk. I vaguely sensed that I was not being any too smart, but I felt reassured I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. So this type of thinking hit Jim suddenly. I mean, it just, he had no thought of drinking. He just wanted to have a bite to eat. And boom, suddenly the thought crossed his mind that, hey, he's got two sandwiches and two glasses of milk in his belly now. He's going to be okay to drink.
And notice what it says. It says he felt reassured. So his mind was telling him a drink would be a good thing. Not even that his mind was telling him they should stay away from it. It was a bad. His mind was telling him a drink would be a good idea.
And as we're going to see at the end of this chapter, he had no mental defense against taking that drink. It came suddenly, and he had no thought or reservation. I mean, this guy didn't even have time to think the drink through, which we hear so often in our fellowship. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. Yet, all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in the favor of the foolish idea, or again, the lie, that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. You know, he had knowledge about himself. We found out in Bill's story that self-knowledge cannot fix this thing. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. And Bill pointed out before a definition of powerlessness that he really likes. And I really love this definition of insanity that this chapter gives. And notice, when I read this, it's not talking about insanity as all the crazy, insane things that we do while we're drinking. The smacked up cars, the ruined relationships, lost houses, on and on and on and on. Not that you necessarily have to have those things to be an alcoholic, but those things are just a manifestation of drinking. Those are things that happen as the result of being intoxicated by a poison called alcohol. That's not the insanity that this book is describing. The insanity that it's talking about is the mental state that precedes the first drink. So whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity, and here's the definition. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? Insanity is a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. Were you ever rubber-minded? You may think this is an extreme case. To us it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did on the consequences, but there is always the curious mental phenomena that parallel with our sound reasoning. There inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse, and I'm remembering John's example, for taking that first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how it could have happened. And again, bring your own experience to the book. See if you had an example like this, like Jim did. In some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by more mental states preceding the first drink: nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we were obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. And what always happened was, once we put any alcohol into our system whatsoever, it sparked a physical craving which doomed us to go on to drinking, which started that cycle. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be.
Okay, can I just stop?
Yeah.
We're gonna stop there. But in closing, or for me in closing, you'll notice how many times on this page he describes the mental obsession. On the first line, he calls it the foolish idea. Three lines later, he calls it plain insanity. A couple words later, he calls it a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. Six lines later, he calls it the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning. The next line, he calls it insanely trivial excuse. The next line, he calls it our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. Next line, the insane idea. Seven lines later, he calls it our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient. And then two lines later, he calls it there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. So again, he's saying the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, using different words. Whichever one you like best, go for it. Or make one up of your own, but it's all describing the same thing. And you know, again, it's describing the experience of an alcoholic. So ask yourself if that's your experience.
Can you review the packet?
Just to touch upon what's in the packet, we have some good news and we have some bad news. sorry. The first part, which I think is really cool, is we just touched upon a couple stories, and throughout the book we've touched upon some historical events and some people and some places. And this big book name and date reference describes almost all of the people that are described there, the places, the time of year it was, where it occurred, who's involved. I guess that's, there's about 7 pages of that. That goes all the way to the second story in the story section of it. So it covers a lot of history and a lot of references of who are they talking about and what are they talking about. The part that's maybe not such good news is there's some homework for everybody.
Oh, boy. I knew you'd do it.
I gotta go. Since, I don't know, do we want to do that? Since we're not done with the chapter? Or?
Well, here's my... procrastination. Here's my vision for next week. We'll pick it back up with page 37. Go to the end of the chapter, which ends on 43... We'll touch upon the first page of We Agnostics, which is a review of everything we've covered before. Then we'll get into page 52, and that's where we'll spend a little bit of time talking about what I consider to be the second half of the first step, or the third part of the first step, which is that our lives have become unmanageable, or if you wish, you can call it the spiritual malady. So I actually think this would be a good exercise to do between this week and next, since we're gonna cover the spiritual malady next week, and we're also going to wrap up the first, hopefully if all goes according to no plan, we'll wrap up the first step, and we can all take the first step together. And then the week after that, we'll get into We Agnostics and do the second step.
And just to kind of describe what that step one unmanageability exercise is, Mike had touched upon page 52, and that's probably the best paragraph in the book that describes a lot of the spiritual malady and what it looks like when we're blocked off spiritually. But throughout the book, there's many references. Not many, but there's a whole bunch of references to it. And what this unmanageability exercise, where it came from, is there's 15 different references, and it even says what page number is on there during the exercise. And then there's questions that revolve around those 15 areas that are described in the big book of what does the spiritual malady look like? What does the unmanageability look like, drinking or not? So if you could, over the next week, fill that out, honestly, and it's describing currently how you're doing in those areas. So it was really eye-opening for me, not only in doing that, but also in putting together the exercise and hearing feedback of other people that are now using it. It's also, coincidentally, in the current This Day newsletter. I don't know if anybody reads the Area 44 This Day newsletter that comes out quarterly, but Mike has an article in there of what's the spiritual malady? You know, there's physical, mental, and spiritual aspects of alcoholism. The book talks about the spiritual malady. It talks about unmanageability, but what does that look like? And these 15 areas speak directly to that. And we can ask ourselves, you know, how am I currently doing in these areas? And and that's something I guess we can bring next week too.
Yeah.
I can have as a handout is spiritual malady descriptions, and you know, it's pretty much all out of the big book with some explanation of what does all that stuff look like. Because, you know, for me, people are always baffled when somebody who has 25 years goes back out. And to be honest with you, it doesn't really baffle me because it's because of that stuff. It doesn't matter how far we are.
you know, it even says that at the end of the opening of this, it doesn't matter so much how far we are from our last drink. What matters is how close are we to our next one. And this exercise will describe how close you are to your next drink.
I like to suggest that that you do this as a prayerful or a meditative exercise rather than doing it on the bus, on the way to work, or you know, doing it in the John or whatever. Get quiet, get centered with whatever your conception of God is. Say a prayer, maybe even the set-aside prayer before going into it, and really try to be honest with yourself, with where you are today, with the stuff, with the 15 areas that this exercise is talking about. This exercise isn't concerned with what you were like 10 years ago. It's talking about where am I with this part of the first step today. And again, like I always say, it's this part of the first step. It's this stuff that's in this 15 areas. It's the spiritual malady that's going to spark the mental obsession. It's the mental obsession that's going to eventually lead me to picking up the first drink. And it's the first drink that's going to cause me to spark off the physical craving. And it's the physical craving that's going to hook me back around into the senseless series of sprees. You know, so this is the missing piece, so to speak. And that's what I entitled that article that Bill was talking about. This is the stuff that you don't really hear about in meetings. You hear the symptoms of this stuff, you know, but we don't really get down to the core and to the root of exactly what the spiritual malady is today and how it affects my life today and how it actually has the capability of bringing me back to a drink today, whether I think so or not.
Whether it's been a long time or not.
Yep. So that's all we have for this week, and we'd like to open it up at this point.